You're listening to Home by Starlight, Poets in Conversation, with Paula Meehan and Joyce Sutphen, a special episode of Friendly Connections, the official podcast of the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm your host, Chase Maxwell. The Friends and the Center for Irish Studies at the University of St. Thomas have had a long and fruitful partnership. Every year, the Friends are delighted to co-host a Writers in Conversation event featuring the recipient of the Lawrence O'Shaughnessy Award for Poetry. In the case of this year, poet Paula Meehan. Joining Meehan is Joyce Sutphen, Minnesota's Poet Laureate. Moderating the discussion is the director of the Center for Irish Studies, James Rogers. Thank you again for listening.
Brief, because I realize we're here to hear from our poet friends, but I think most of us here certainly know Joyce as the Poet Laureate of Minnesota. What we may not know is that she has a new book out like yesterday, and the books are for sale in the back room, as well as Paula's books are for sale. New book, Modern Love and Other Myths.
It's a great title.
And Joyce teaches at Gustavus Adolphus and does a totally irrational commute to and from Gustavus and out here to come to all these poetry things, and it's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you.
I will talk more about the poet laureate. Paula Meehan comes to us all the way from Dublin. She is the recipient of the 19th O'Shaughnessy Poetry Award. This is an honor unique in North America, given by the Center for Irish Studies at the University of St. Thomas. It's a cash award that honors excellence in poetry, that honors the contribution, not only the excellence of the work, but also the large-heartedness and the contribution of this person to the life of poetry in Ireland, and indeed, in Paula's case, far beyond. Paula was born in Dublin in 1955 in a working-class neighborhood, and was educated at Trinity College Dublin and also at Eastern Washington University, where she studied with Jim McCauley and Gary Snyder. And so, and she is the author of, I've lost count of how many, is it seven books of poems or eight now? Seven books of poems and eight plays, and we were honored to present the O'Shaughnessy Poetry Award to her last night. I think before we start talking about, the title is Home by Starlight, which is a deliberately far-reaching and non-restrictive title, but I think it would be nice to hear a little bit, if you could speak briefly about your life as public poets. Paula holds the Ireland Chair of Poetry in Ireland. Mm-hmm. We described her seriously as Ireland's poet in chief. so could you just talk briefly a little about what that is?
Well, I'm still waiting for the chair because I haven't sat down since I got this job. It's a position that lasts for 3 years, and every 3 years a new poet is chosen to occupy the imaginary chair. The job was set up in 1998 to honour, can you hear me at the back yet? To honour Seamus Heaney's Nobel laureateship. And I think he was asked, would you like a statue or a plaque? And he said, no, I'd like to see poetry represented to the community and in the universities by a working poet. So I feel I've come in from the wild into the universities. And although I work with the students in the universities north and south, because it's a cross-border position, I also, most of my work focuses on outreach out into the community to writing groups or wherever there's an appetite for poetry. So that's it in a nutshell.
I was just going to say, it's hard to follow such a beautiful lilting sound with my Minnesota sounds, but it's the Poet Laureate of Minnesota doesn't have a chair, or at least not one that I've seen so far, and there seems to be a kind of an open idea of how long the position would last, and so if anyone is, you know, eager for a new Poet Laureate, you might agitate a little bit for that. I've had a really good time doing all sorts of things, including visiting schools. Just day before yesterday, I went to a fifth grade class, and they were astounding. They were so lively, so eager. And I did tell my college class about them and kind of invited them to act more like 11-year-olds. I've judged contests and, you know, kind of basically I've done the sort of thing I've always done, which is say yes to everything. And so it's...
We were just at dinner together, and one of the things that seemed striking as we were talking is, you know, here we have someone from Dublin, someone from central Minnesota, and yet there are some remarkable, as different as they are, some commonalities. Mm-hmm. They are both the oldest children in their family, oldest children in their family. Home
big
by starlight.
Big families.
In a large family?
Big families.
Big families. Both
what's
seven?
Nine.
Six.
Six.
Relatively modest.
Well, the first word in the program is home, home by starlight. Hmm. Tell us about home. Tell me about your home where you grew up, Paula.
Okay. Well, I grew up in the north inner city of Dublin, which is a territory that has been extensively mapped by other writers. I grew up in the tenements, which were the old Georgian houses of the ascendancy, cast off and used for every room would have a family living in it. So I grew up in this huge these huge Georgian rooms with my family, a very close-knit community within the city, the larger city. Really, it was like growing up in a village. And I didn't realize I was underprivileged till I went to school and they told me I was underprivileged. Because for me, it was just a magical place to grow up. Very few books. I'm in traditional inner city upbringing. Very few books, but a lot of story, a lot of song, and a lot of, you know, recitation. I mean, people did monologues, dramatic monologues, to entertain each other. So really, I grew up amongst what would be the grandchildren of Sean O'Casey's people. In the same area, Mountjoy Square, Sean McDermott Street, Gardner Street. I was the eldest of a family of six. My mother was a ferocious woman, ferocious belief in education for her girls. My father was a traditional Dublin man. He didn't learn to give hugs till he was in his 70s. So lots of unemployment, the 50s. My father and mother were back and forth to London for work, and I spent a lot of my childhood with my grandparents, which was a real gift because they told me I was the center of the universe and that I was great. And there was very little in the culture that was going to tell me that afterwards.
Oh, that's so lovely. Your grandmother. My grandmother was pretty important too. She'd been on the farm that my parents took over just before I was born. And my grandfather died very young at, you know, 54 or so. They'd retired. And so my grandmother took an interest in the farm in that she came out daily in the summer and worked on the gardens and the strawberry patches and the canning and everything. And she took home mending. And, you know, she was also an encourager for me. I think that, you know, I'm the opposite. I grew up with cows, not hogs. I mean, closest neighbor was pretty far across the fields, and the ones that were close didn't have kids. And so it was pretty much our little tribe, wild people, wild kids. And we didn't have really many books or anything either. I'd sneak up in the attic and, like, read some of the books my dad had in high school. Mm-hmm. And also, we didn't have as much storytelling. I'm sad to say we were typical Lake Wobegonians, very quiet. My father loved to rhyme, though. He would do these sort of Bob Dylan type rhymes that were kind of goofy, you know, like just one rhyme coming after the other. And then my mother was very plain. She wanted everything concise. She didn't want any foolishness or anything. And, so I think that his whimsical way of rhyming and everything, and my mother's succinctness, that probably makes a good combination. So anyway.
I hope we'll come back to this. You both mentioned this discovery of reading and writing, and maybe we'll have a chance a little later to talk about that as a part of your of your development. But we are here to hear you as poets, so I wonder if we could hear from each of you a poem that somehow involves the notion of home. Joyce, do you have one to hand?
Well, I suppose the quintessential expression of my home place is this early poem called The Farm. It's a little mythical. I'll read it, and then maybe I'll get a chance to read something more, cleaning out the calf pen or something like that. I don't know if I have that exact poem, but this one called The Farm. The farm. My father's farm is an apple blossomer. He keeps his hills in dandelion carpet and weaves a lane of lilacs between the rows and the jack in the pulpits. His sleek cows ripple in the pastures. The dog and purple iris keep watch at the garden's end. His farm is rolling thunder, a lightning bolt on the horizon. His crops suck rain from the sky and swallow the smoldering sun. His fields are oceans of heat where waves of gold beat the burning shore. A red fox pauses under the birch trees. A shadow is in the river's bend. When the hawk circles the land, my father's grain fields whirl beneath it. Owls gather together to sing in his woods, and the deer run his golden meadow. My father's farm is an icicle, a hill of white powder. He parts the snowy sea and smooths away the valleys. He cultivates his rows of starlight and drags the crescent moon through dark, unfurrowed fields.
Beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
You got home and starlight there.
Yeah, I thought I'd read The Pattern, actually, as a poem of home, of the mother, of my relationship with my mother. My mother died when she was 42, and the last few years of her life were very difficult, I believe, undiagnosed postnatal depression. As I said, she was a ferociously intelligent woman, and a ferociously intelligent woman, and a great force of nature. Unfortunately, I believe part of you know, the process of her leaving this world was to do with a kind of internalized oppression from the outside that kind of then ate her really from the inside. So, so this poem came out of my attempt to estimate her legacy, because she was a wonderful craftswoman. She made us beautiful things with her hands, embroidered, crocheted, knitted, woven. And yet, you know, as children, we wouldn't appreciate that at all. We just wanted to look like all the other girls in the tenements. So The Pattern. Little has come down to me of hers, a sewing machine, a wedding band, a clutch of photos, the sting of her hand across my face in one of our wars when we had grown bitter and apart. Some say that's the fate of the eldest daughter. I wish now she'd lasted till after I'd grown up. We might have made a new start as women without tags like mother, wife, sister, daughter, taking our chances from there. At 42, she headed for God knows where. I've never gone back to visit her grave. First, she'd scrub the floor with sunlight soap, an arm reach at a time. When her knees grew sore, she'd break for a cup of tea, then start again at the door with lavender polish. The smell would percolate back through the flat to us, her brood banished to the bedroom. And as she buffed the wax to a high shine, did she catch her own face coming clear? Did she net a glimmer of her true self? Did her mirror tell her what mine tells me? I have her shrug and go on, knowing history has brought her to her knees. She'd call us in and let us skate around in our socks. We'd grow solemn as planets in an intricate orbit about her. She's bending over crimson cloth. The younger kids are long in bed. Late summer, cold enough for a fire, she works by fading light to remake an old dress for me. It's first day back at school tomorrow. Pure lamb's wool, plenty of wear in a jet. You know I wore this when I went out with your da. I was supposed to be down in a friend's house. Your granda caught us at the corner. He dragged me in by the hair. It was long as yours then, in front of the whole street. He called your da every name under the sun. Corner boy, lout. I needn't tell you what he called me. He shoved my whole head under the kitchen tap, took a scrubbing brush and carbolic soap, and in ice cold water, he scrubbed every spick of lipstick and mascara off my face. Christ, but he was a right tyrant, your grandad. It'll be over my dead body anyone harms a hair of your head. She must have stayed up half the night to finish the dress. I found it airing at the fire, three new copybooks on the table and a bright bronze nib. St. Christopher strung on a silver wire as if I were embarking on a perilous journey to uncharted realms. I wore that dress with little grace. To me it spelt poverty, the stigma of the second hand. I grew enough to pass it on by Christmas to the next in line. I was sizing up the world beyond our flat, patch by patch, daily after school, and fitting each surprising city street to city square to diamond. I'd watch the Liffey for hours pulsing to the sea and the coming and going of ships, certain that one day it would carry me to Zanzibar, Bombay, the land of the Ethiopes. There's a photo of her taken in the Phoenix Park, alone on a bench surrounded by roses, as if she had been born to formal gardens. She stares out as if unaware that any human hand held the camera, wrapped entirely in her own shadow, the world beyond her, already a dream, already lost. She's 8 months pregnant, her last child. Her steel needle sparked and clacked, the only other sound a settling coal, or her sporadic mutter at a hard part in the pattern. She favoured sensible shades, musk green, mustard, beige. I dreamt a robe of a colour so pure it became a word. Sometimes I'd have to kneel an hour before her by the fire, a skein around my outstretched hands while she rolled wool into balls. If I swam like a kite, too high amongst the shadows on the ceiling, or flew like a fish in the pools of pulsing light, she'd reel me firmly home. She'd land me at her knees, tongues of flame in her dark eyes. She'd say, one of these days I must teach you to follow a pattern.
Thank you. Remarkable. Just to stay with the notion of home for a little bit, could you talk a little bit just how, I'm not sure I'm framing this question, how poetry became your home? Is poetry in what sense is poetry a home to you? Could you speak to that a little bit?
Well, I just I'll have this quote correct. Czesław Miłosz said, "Language is the only home." I just love that. But let me think for a second. Paula, do you have something? I just wanted to get that quote.
Well done. We're glad we're here. So.
How is poetry a home? How has poetry become a home? I'm thinking.
Okay, we'll hear from Paula.
I suppose it's It's a site for reconstruction of all the possibilities around home. I think when I was starting out to write poetry, I suppose you're trying on different voices and trying on different outfits as a poet. Until you find, I suppose they could talk about finding your voice, you know. And it seems like there's a moment when you come home to yourself in language, and you begin then, it's a bit like constructing a shell. I often think of it, of myself as a little crustacean, and I form these protect, you know, the shell becomes both home and also protection, because I have found it to be an incredibly protected place once I gave myself to poetry. And even to this day, I'm reluctant to say I am a poet, you know, to give myself that label or title. And it's mostly other people tell me I'm a poet, so I do accept it. But it seems to be a site where I can be myself, at home in language, and also a place where I feel safe to say the things I need to say that I can't say in any other way. But by ritualizing them in language, it seems like I have great freedom to speak my own truths about the world I've lived, the life I've lived, the communities I've lived in. And sometimes, while I'm very wary about speaking on behalf of other people, I do think that sometimes I'm channeling, you know, I don't believe that the poet is necessarily some kind of isolated, elitist being up there somewhere in the corner. You know, I do think that we do work just as we dream for our communities. I think we make poems for our communities.
I think I'm going to read a poem. And I can find it pretty quickly. It's called How You Learn. And it has the word pattern in it. And it, I think, maybe addresses this question. How you learn. You don't need new words or even new ways of putting one word next to another. No, you simply need to be touched by the God who has you tell what was not in your mind. You just need to let it come the way it will as it leaps across the land, skipping the way you usually try to build a fire, teaching you how to drive through the dark. You don't need to prepare, except that you already have in all the lost pages and the sounds that dissolved on your tongue. At that moment, you gather up the years like a shawl and wrap yourself in them, one corner touching another. Everything you have done is suddenly useful. And it turns out there's a pattern after all.
Mm, beautiful. Bravo.
I was thinking that in some ways a slightly different side from what you said so eloquently about living in the work that you're making and doing is actually living in all the poems and that you've loved along the way. And in my case, I'm an obsessive memorizer, and I have this country homeland of poems that you know, it seems like it's made a new continent in my mind anyway. So
that's wonderful. Thanks.
Yeah, beautiful.
You know, did you want to add anything before we do it?
No, I'm just appreciating the poem. I love it. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Patterns.
Patterns.
More patterns. But Paula, the given note here is Home by Starlight, which is the title of a poem, of one of your poems. And I wonder if we could ask you to read that poem and tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I'd love to read it. It's a poem I wrote. It's dedicated to a friend of mine, a German woman, who spent her childhood after the war in a displaced persons camp. And I sometimes think that's, you know, that's been a keynote kind of my own life, you know, the sense of displacement even within the Irish tradition. And her stories of her childhood, of those terrible conditions of Germany after the war, the reconstruction, she was from Berlin, and it was pretty much obliterated towards the end of the war, and, you know, picking through the rubble and ending up as a child in the displaced camp. And the kind of sense of persecution that she had, I wrote this for her, I suppose, as a way of comforting her. She had moved to Ireland as a middle-aged woman. She's a writer as well, poet. And I had this sense that the way that writers and poets kind of move through the world is maybe not in the direct sunlight, you know, the direct path, the A to B, that our maps are probably, you know, self-generated and strange, but they're maps and they're strong maps, and that we often are making, again, to go back to dreaming for the community, that sometimes we are making maps. And just as you have, you know, populated your mind with these, with the poetry of others, I too have used the tradition of poetry as a way of surviving contemporary life. So that's, I suppose, the genesis of the poem. It was written really also recognized the generations of persecution that I felt empathy for. I know witches were often burnt and in Europe, and they were often just women who knew things like herbalism or who would be, you know, local holders of certain kinds of knowledge, and how easy it is to persecute people who don't, you know, look like everybody else. So, Home by Starlight. You ask me which I prefer, the stars themselves or their mirror image on the puddles of our path home. Their light as strong as moonlight, the night cold and still. We take a short cut across an overgrown rath, old stones that seem to spill haphazardly, but if you haul back the long ivy tendrils, hack through the brambles, you will find patterns there. You will know, lifetimes ago, we gazed at the same constellations, amazed by such brilliance, and found in their rule the measure of each year, each journey. Do you remember how it was, the seasons of study in the star school, scanning for portent conjugations of sky beasts that peopled the sea of our heavens? Do you remember that crazy light we tracked one midwinter, the light they later called the Christos, and the terror, the blood cost of that logos? How our arts were eclipsed, and many gentle comrades were tortured and burned. How the songs we had crafted for travel were lost, language itself lost, when we were scattered like sparks to the wind. So well, you might ask, the light or its image, turned in a puddle, sure-footed friend on the path you roam, by the light of a million, million suns home.
That's a beautiful poem, and I've read it a couple times. I don't know that I am wise enough to comment or interpret, except that I think I was surprised as I was thinking about today, and I was just looking through poems, I was surprised at how many poems I have that have refugees and immigrants in them, and I have no idea, but I think maybe we do feel like pilgrims and wanderers on the earth, and maybe there's something in that.
There's a distinction maybe between being a pilgrim and a wanderer and being a displaced. person, and mm-hmm. maybe yeah. it sounds like being displaced is very important in what you mm-hmm. written.
Yeah, I just think that, I mean, I don't think it's common. I think it's common amongst poets to feel an empathy or an identification with that what's Widdershins, you know, or skewed, or the uncomfortable thing. The one, I mean, some of our traditional role has been around speaking truth to power. I know that's nearly a cliche now as a phrase. But certainly there has been, I would feel that as part of my responsibility. And sometimes, you know, when you speak the truth to power, you know, you get into trouble. And it feels like we have to be able for that and ready for it, you know. And it seems more and more that, as, you know, I remember reading in an interview that Gary Snyder, who's a very important poet to me, came to Washington State when I was a student, and he was this distinguished visiting poet. And I had been reading him since I was a teenager, so it was like meeting a great hero. And he lived up to all my expectations, which, you know, meeting your heroes isn't always like that. But he said in a Paris interview, he was asked why there's so little kind of apocalyptic stuff in his poetry, considering that he is the great American environmentalist poet of the environment, and now that it was under such threat, how little there was of, you know, the apocalyptic vision. And he said, oh, but first we must learn to love the earth before we can save it. And his work has, you know, exemplified that love of the planet. And I suppose I would feel the same about communities I've lived in. The community I've lived in and grew up in was always on the edge, you know, it was always marginalized, just by nature of being poor and being an inner city community. And then, you know, the present day Dublin that I live in is one of many migrant people. You know, it's like Finnegan's Wake come home to the city. You hear your ear snags on Latvian, Russian, Mandarin, Yoruba, Igbo. I mean, I grew up in a monocultural white community. And that same community in Dublin now is just, I mean, it really is vital with the children of so many different backgrounds. You were talking about visiting the school, and I went back to my old school last year, and they had all done these little poems about their memories. Now, they're only 12 years old. They were doing childhood memories. And, you know, it was fantastic. You know, there was a poem from a Polish boy about being on his granny's farm and taking the eggs from under the hen. And there was a poem from a Nigerian girl, daughter of a refugee, going through the marketplace in Nigeria with all the colours and scents. There was a Latvian poem. There was a girl from whose home tongue would be Mandarin Chinese. So, I mean, I live in a Dublin that is full of the displaced, full of people who've come, either economic migrants or refugees, you know, from sometimes terrible, unimaginable circumstances. So I feel that my responsibility is to stand with them.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm mindful of time running along here because I do want to save some time for questions. And I think I think the way to proceed now is to ask each of you to pick a poem of your own selection, introduce it, and then we'll open the floor to questions. So Joyce, do you have a poem you might want to share with us? Let's hear something from the new book. Come on, the one hot off the presses.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, there isn't any title poem, which is unusual. I usually have my books come from a poem in the book, but I'll read this one thinking of a friend who isn't here because he's driving Paula's partner up to Stearns County, the kind of funny, that's my hometown. And I think the inspiration was talking about a tree that was going down in Tim's neighborhood. And, you know, we've gotten so comfortable that we would tell each other what we were writing about. And he said, I'm not going to write about this tree. I've been writing about everything. I'm not going to write about this big tree. Just shoot me if I write about this tree. And I, the next day he said, I wrote about the tree. And so this is called The Poem You Said You Wouldn't Write. The poem you said you wouldn't write is the one I find myself reading this morning. And even though I should be doing something else, I find I can't help writing this poem about sunlit patterns falling across my desk, the sound of cars starting up in the neighborhood, and how it helps to have these poems from you, the evidence of things unseen, the substance of hope that there will always be someone, the boy sitting out on the front step of his with his transistor radio, listening to news about Fidel Castro, or the man sitting in his green lawn chair, watching how the sky can be emptied of leaf, branch, and trunk until nothing is left but stump and sawdust and your poem about the tree, the one you said you wouldn't write, the one that holds the branches high.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah.
So,
is that the first time you've read that poem?
Yes.
All right.
You can tell.
No. Paula, do you want to select one?
Well, given that it's Earth Day, it is Earth Day. And I suppose one of the most profound moments of my life was seeing the planet from space after the moon landing. You know, that image. I mean, I think that did have a huge effect on a whole generation, and was, I think, the beginning of the understanding of how involved we all are with each other's lives, whether we want to be or not. So this poem is about, it came out of research that was done at Trinity College Dublin, at Penn State University here in the United States, and at Oxford University in England. And they discovered, they sampled bones of bears from 27 sites, mostly cave sites, around Ireland. And they discovered that every single polar bear alive today has mitochondrial DNA from one Irish brown bear. The research was published in Current Biology in 2011, if any of you want to check it out. But I found that so mind-expanding, it just seemed to call out for a poem. And of course, remembering that Artemis, the Greek goddess, in her name is, you know, the bear is in there. Arctic is the place where the bears live. And in Artemis, at the root of her name, is the great bear mother of even pre-classical mythology. So I couldn't resist. And I found it incredibly comforting that even though what was there before the polar bear is gone, in the face of massive climate change, which was the end of the last ice age, that there's still something survived. It mightn't be what we'd like to survive as, but, you know, in these days of huge similar climate change, you know, that something will survive. So it's called The Solace of Artemis. I read that every polar bear alive has mitochondrial DNA from a common mother, an Irish brown bear, who once roved out across the last ice age, and I am comforted. It has been a long, hot morning with the children of the machine. Their talk of memory, of buying it cheap. But I, memory keeper by trade, scan time coded in the golden hive mind of eternity. I burn my books. I burn my whole archive, a blaze that sears, synapses flaring, cell to cell, where memory sleeps in the wax hexagonals of my doomed and melting comb. I see him loping towards me across the vast ice field, to where I wait in the cave mouths, dreaming my cubs about the den, my honeyed ones, smelling of snow and sweet oblivion.
Apocalyptic.
We've reached one of the best parts of the episode, the Q&A with our two poets and our dedicated audience. The first question, addressed to Paula Meehan, is about Earth Day in Ireland, following Paula's recitation of her poem, The Solace of Artemis. How is Earth Day celebrated in Ireland? Is it at all similar to the U.S., or are there different traditions?
Probably not with the same consciousness. I mean, I'd say it's, you know, in there's different pockets of awareness about it. But it's a growing thing, which is good, you know. And I certainly celebrate it and talk about it when I get the chance, you know, at this time of year. Yeah.
The next question is addressed to both poets. How did they get started as poets? How did they originally develop a passion for poetry?
I started and stopped and started and stopped and started. I think probably high school wrote. I had Catholic nuns for my education for about 12 years, and but there was that wonderful time in high school when there were nuns who would bring guitars to English class and sing Peter, Paul, and Mary's songs, that sort of thing. And I remember loving E.E. Cummings and writing some poems. When I got to college, I thought, I need to learn so much. I started reading poets that just astounded me. And I thought, I need to practice. I need to do that. But of course, the best laid plans, you know, things went off the tracks for a while, and I didn't come back until later. And we talked about this. My studies at the university were all in prose, memoir, and fiction. So poetry just kind of came back when I was about 40. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of unusual, isn't it?
I don't know. It's how it is for me.
It sounds to me like a very common pattern for women in the trade, you know, that they write when they're young and write until they have children. And they might be still writing, but sometimes, unless you're very lucky and you have childcare, sometimes the rearing of the children takes you out of the zones of easy access to a literary milieu. So, you know, that isolation can sometimes cut you off. Because I know a lot of my workshops that I do in the community, and I think this is a common experience, it's often women coming back into the trade, into the craft, and wanting to reconnect and pick up the pieces of work that they let slip through, you know, years devoted to child rearing. So I think that's a very common pattern. I started fairly early, and you know, it actually came as a shock that I'd actually have to do a bit of work. You know, I always felt like a writer. And then one day I realized, oh God, I have to sit down and actually make the things. And how do you do that? And where do you start? But I think the big energy boost was as a teenager, where, you know, the lyric, we were always, as kids, we were always in and out of bands, where I'd moved to the suburbs by then, and that's the real, you know, that's the real culture of the suburbs, even to this day in Dublin. You know, there's lots of bands, kids, music. So that was it, and the lyric was just the natural thing, you know. It felt very natural extension of making songs. I just got fed up with all these egomaniac boys with guitars, you know. So I kind of drifted out of that and more into the poetry itself. So, but it was a great time for the lyric.
The next question is addressed to Paula Meehan, referencing a statement Meehan made earlier in the episode about storytelling being central to her upbringing. The audience member speculates that this tradition of storytelling was largely dominated by men. How did women fit into this tradition of storytelling in Ireland?
Yeah, well, I think you have to bear in mind that we lost a language when we lost sovereignty. You know, we were a colonized people, and we lost all, as you must know here on the continent here, how many survival strategies were lost with the loss of native languages. So we've that colonized history to work through. Certainly I have come through the gender wars in poetry, which I think are germane all over the world, you know. Where women had to really, fight for the right to be heard. When my second slim volume was published, one of the reviews said, until recently, a woman writing poetry was as rare as a white black bird. I mean, that was one of the reviewer's comments, you know. Which wasn't true, because it wasn't that we weren't writing it, we just weren't getting the opportunity to publish. So there's been a lot of struggle around those issues. And now it would be probably unthinkable to publish an anthology of Irish poetry without having a huge representation by women. But in the far tradition, I was talking to Nuala Ní Gonal, one of our great Irish language poets, and she said that there's a lot of taboo in the Irish language tradition around women writing. There were women writers, but it was believed that if poetry came to a woman in your family, it left the family for seven generations, as if she somehow magically used up all the air. And it was also, there was a kind of a, what we call a pishog, which is a kind of folkloric superstition, that women had incredibly long tongues that they rolled up inside their mouths. So, I mean, it's not just in the English tradition, the English writing tradition, that we're suspect. Seemingly in the old Irish, we were suspect too.
The final question is about poetry itself. How did both poets come to deeply understand the mechanics of poetry, such as rhythm and cadence? Is it an innate ability or something they acquired over the years?
Where are some of those sources? Well, I was just thinking of a poem of mine that ends with the combination of Latin, intro, ibi, all, ad altare dei. It's been a long time since I heard that Latin, and the sound of milk machines, like the rhythmic. Hear it. I can just, you know. I mean, so yeah. What about you, Paula? What are your home rhythms? Oh, hey, girl.
Yeah, I know. Well, it seems to be the essential thing, isn't it? In poetry, whatever else happens, it has to have a beat.
Music.
Yeah, I mean, that's the essential ingredient. And I suppose, you know, I think it's something to do with maybe behind everything, the poetry is an attempt to get back to the comfort of the, you know, if people are in deep grief, you'll notice how their body begins to move into a rhythm. So I think somewhere in there is that truth that the enormous comfort of poetry has at its root that return to maybe some kind of womb, because, you know, the first access we have to anything like ritualized sound is our mother's heartbeat before we're even born. So I really, well, certainly I feel that's the, What drives me is that absolute comfort of mesmeric sound.
If you enjoyed this podcast and the other programming provided by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library, consider subscribing to this podcast, which will be updated with new episodes throughout the year, including the popular Fireside Reading series. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/friendsofsppl and on Twitter at The Friends. Visit our website, thefriends.org, for event listings and news. Thank you for listening.